This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick.
As political journalists, it is easy to get wrapped up in the story of the day. Elections, court decisions, wars, strikes, retirements, deaths. This year has had its fair share of big news, and it also has the feel of being a transitional time. Just in the last few days, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor all died. But what news events will endure and mark this year as unique? 50 years ago, in 1973, we had Watergate, Roe versus Wade, the end of the Vietnam War, and others. When we consider what happened this year, there are a few things that have the potential to stick out and continue to influence historians and their view of this time. And what better person to discuss this with than Nathan Gonzalez, our elections analyst here at Roll Call, and the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Nathan, welcome back to Political Theater.
Thank you. And resident Henry Kissinger expert.
Yes, I was going to say.
Well, when you I heard you say 2073, I was thinking in 2073, I'll be, spoiler alert, I'll be 96 years old and finishing my second term as president of the United States. So that's where we will be in 2073, looking back to 2023.
Yes, looking back at all that's transpired from there. I mean, peeling back the curtain a little bit. I mean, this year is when people, you know, do their best of, you know, like best, you know, photographs of the year, best stories of the year.
Roll Call will win all the best photographs of the year.
Of course. Know. Well, they usually do. At least we get our fair share, right? But I wanted to reframe this and think about, I mean, maybe I just have this on the brain of things for posterity, because we've seen, you know, just in the last couple of days, also in addition to the some of the deaths that I mentioned, we've had you know, things like Vice President Kamala Harris set the record for tie-breaking votes in the Senate. There are things like that that are a big deal, but I don't know that that's going to be in the encyclopedia. I don't know if the robot who's writing news stories in 50 years will ask the historian robot what the, you know, to give them basically the top five stories. But I think that this does feel like a big year. It does feel like there was a lot that happened, and that we should sort of take note and also point out how it could continue to resonate in the coming years.
Yeah, I agree. It's always good to try to take a step back and or take a long step forward in order to look back. So yeah, let's do it.
And I should note too that sometimes, you know, with hindsight, you know, we see that a big story continued to resonate and maybe even got more important as the years went on. So Roe versus Wade was a big deal in 1973, but it just became more important. You know, I mean, it seems as if, I mean, I remember reading about this. It was our former colleague, Amanda Becker, who's writing a story or writing a book, rather, along a set of stories, a book about the post-Dobbs decision world. And she pointed out to me in one of our conversations that after the Roe versus Wade decision, John Paul Stevens, who had been nominated by President Ford a couple of years later to be a Supreme Court justice, was not asked about Roe versus Wade at his confirmation hearing. But now Roe just became the storyline for all abortion related debate, and it you know, was when it was overturned, we are still now dealing with the fallout of its overturning. You know, Watergate, this is a huge story. I mean, Nixon started his first term in January, or second term in January, rather. And Watergate was just getting going. And by October, you know, he had fired, you know, Archibald Cox, a special counsel. He had an attorney general resign. I mean, it was just this total mess. He also lost his vice president, Spiro Agnew, who had pleaded guilty to tax evasion. And yeah, there's just these things that are really, they take hold, in it. And I feel like there are a few of those things. Let's start with the big one. You know, we found out before this podcast that Kevin McCarthy, the former Speaker of the House, will resign his seat before the end of the year. You know, this year sort of started with McCarthy with 15 rounds, you know, with the new Congress, 15 rounds he had to go to even get elected Speaker because of the margins, you know, for the Republicans were not very high. He didn't have much of a cushion, and he was booted out of by his colleagues, became the first Speaker of the House booted by his colleagues in October. We spent three weeks trying to figure out what was next and who would be the next Speaker. And now it ends sort of with him, you know, saying, I've got better things to do than serve out my term. But I feel like that speaks to larger issues as well about what we're seeing in Congress.
I guess it could go two different ways focusing on that news event, right? It could be, well, that set a precedent for other parties and other future Congresses, you know, ousting their speaker and going through that whole process. Or it could stick out as a moment in history for it being an aberration, right? It being an exception rather than the rule. It's an asterisk rather than the beginning of a trend. So I think either way that qualifies, and we're still in the wake of that. Like, did that really happen? But yet at the same time, we're already hearing a little bit of grumbling about current Speaker Mike Johnson, right? That, well, they're not satisfied with how he's handling different aid packages or other pieces of legislation. So are Republicans going to go through that, you know, next year? It still remains to be seen, but feels like it's more likely to be a history, a footnote as an aberration rather than a beginning of a trend.
And I wonder that. I mean, there's been more than one, you know, sort of political journalists or political theorist say, does this portend, you know, sort of the end of the Republican Party as we know it? Because McCarthy, even as conservative as some of his positions are, did represent a little bit more of a mainstream. I can still work with Democrats even when I'm, you know, kind of calling them out publicly and so forth. He raised a lot of money. He was like very chummy with the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, like what we think of as sort of traditional Republican, you know, politics. And, you know, Johnson comes from a little bit more of the social, you know, kind of culture warrior thing. He doesn't have a big track record of raising a lot of money from Wall Street and so forth. But I wonder if like that's already over, and this is the party is become a little bit more like Johnson and Donald Trump, who we'll get to in a few minutes, in terms of news events, than it'll ever be like McCarthy again.
Yeah, 50 years is a long time. That is a long time, you know, to then look back. At least one of the parties could look very differently. Or when I was trying to think about this, will we look back at this time as, oh, how quaint. It was just basically an election between Democrats and Republicans, and where because of so much dissatisfaction with the two parties that there was the appetite for a third party actually grew into something more significant that could be sustainable. I mean, that's a very real possibility, not in the near term, I don't think, but, you know, looking a generation down the line, that we look back and like, oh, that was nice when it was just the two parties duking it out.
I mean, I would be thrilled if they would also take some of just the names of some of the old political parties that haven't made it, and kind of like when an NBA team moves, they keep their name. So like, you know, the Utah Jazz they moved from New Orleans. It was the New Orleans Jazz. Salt Lake City, not known for its jazz, but they kept the name. Same thing with LA, the Lakers, you know, it was the Minneapolis Lakers. That makes sense because Minnesota's the land of 10,000 lakes. I guess there's Silver Lake in Los Angeles, you know, where it's kind of the hipsters live and so forth. It's a great neighborhood, by the way. I love it there. I'm not making fun of it. But not LA, not known for its lakes. More of it's more of a beach town, you might say. So I say we bring back bull moose.
Known more for its concrete.
Yes, yeah. The bull moose story, the bull moose party, the wigs, the know nothings. That's one of my favorites. I think they should just recycle those instead of trying to come up with new party names.
That's what I think for the XFL. They should just take football team names from movies and just try to put them all together in the same league. It's a merchandising bonanza, an opportunity. But what do I know?
You know, this will be our second career. Actually, the view from 2073. This will be the beginning of the Gonzalez Dick sports fake sports merchandising empire.
It rolls off the tongue. I can see it.
I tend to agree. I mean, I think that it's hard to predict, you know, what this effect will be. I mean, I when I talk to people who are not political journalists and I know quite a few of them, I mean, it usually is this thing like, oh yeah, McCarthy.
Yeah. It seems like ancient history now.
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, low those 2 months ago. But I do think that this year has absolutely signaled what we may just keep an eye on, maybe, you know, as the years sort of unfold, too, is that's our homework assignment, by the way, to keep an eye on these things over the next few years, is this felt very unstable from the beginning of this Congress to where we're at the end of the first session. There's a lot of instability. We've lost a month plus just over speaker battles. The beginning of the year in January, it took, you know, a couple of weeks to get McCarthy in, and then it took 3 weeks to get Johnson in. So, you know, that years are comprised of finite time, and a month, solid month of it was lost just to that.
And we'll be 50 years is also long enough to go through multiple cycles of, you know, Democrats having full control in terms of large majorities, but then Republicans having full control and large majorities. And you don't have, I think, some of these speaker battles if one party has a greater margin for some of the outliers, as long as they don't change the rules in order to give a single member of the House power to vacate the chair.
Right.
But we're going to have – there's going to be such – dramatic swings over that period of time.
Yeah. On another matter, this does feel like it will be relevant, or at least, you know, a episode of history that people will continue to know about, which is that a former president of the United States, Donald Trump, was indicted in several different jurisdictions to the tune of 93 different criminal charges, in addition to the civil trials that he's facing as well. We'd never had a president indicted before in federal court. I mean, part of the reason for that is that Gerald Ford decided to pardon Richard Nixon after Nixon had left office. So that could have been something that happened in the 70s, perhaps, but it didn't because Ford pardoned Nixon. But this won't even be confined to this year, because these trials will stretch out into an election year. And then depending on what the outcome of the election is, whether, you know, if Donald Trump is the president, we may see a situation where he pardons himself if he has been convicted of crimes.
If that's allowed, right? We'll find out. Hopefully, yeah. First of all, I agree that we will look back at this as, wow, what? Remember when that happened? But the question is, does it happen again? Meaning, you know, and this could go either way. Hopefully we don't have politicians who elevate to this level who get in that, you know, all sorts of trouble in the same way on their own, or that political parties start using the legal and the court system and the Justice Department and stuff to, you know, exact revenge or to settle political scores. And sadly, we have to leave our minds open to the possibility that this is the beginning of politicians in legal trouble running for office because the judicial system has become, you know, has just become an arm of the campaigns. Right. And, you know, I hope these are aberrations rather than the beginning of trends when we're at, in 2073.
Yeah. I mean, the previous night to the recording of this podcast, Donald Trump did a sort of televised town hall with Sean Hannity in Iowa. And, you know, Hannity asked him, you know, what he thought about, you know, like how he would answer, you know, critics who say that he's setting himself out to be a dictator. And, you know, Trump didn't exactly give an answer that was unequivocally like, oh, no, I will obviously adhere to the vows that I make to uphold the laws of the United States and the Constitution. He said maybe on day one. Right. And then so day one will be the dictatorship. And then like the next day will be fine. You know, go back to the law, rule of law. That is the kind of thing that I think is, you know, this is something that a public figure, a former president of the United States, said on television, said for everyone to hear. And that I think you're right. I mean, the ramifications of what could come from the criminal trials, depending on what happens with him, depending on how he reacts to it, if he wins, is almost sort of incalculable to try to, at this point, to say, you know, what'll happen.
And that's where we have to, that comment, let's say, you know, I expect Trump to be the nominee. Let's say he wins and he, you know, puts in motion all sorts of things. We will look back then at 2023 and say, well, that's, you all should have known that that was going to happen because he said that this is what he was going to do. And so, yeah, that's a, this, that could be a key phrase unfortunately, a key moment that could be remembered for years to come.
Going back to the House, the House last week expelled George Santos, a Republican freshman from New York, from Long Island and Queens. Santos made quite a name for himself as lie after lie was exposed, you know, playing on college volleyball teams, being Jewish, like you name it, and the fraud, you know, that he's been accused of. Now, he was not convicted. He's not been convicted of a crime, but an ethics, you know, committee report came out saying, you know, this is bad. You know, like he has defrauded, you know, people who gave him money for his campaign to spend on himself, like on Ferragamo shoes and so forth. So the House expelled him. He only became the sixth member of the House of Representatives to be expelled by his colleagues. Hadn't happened since Jim Traficant in 2002. So, you know, or 2000. He's also the first person expelled from the House by his colleagues who was not convicted of a crime or was part of the Confederacy. So, how important do you think that is? Is that one of those precedents where we've already seen, particularly in the House, censure resolutions almost become meaningless because everybody keeps on filing censure resolutions because they don't like the cut of your jib, I guess. Like, is this just going to become like the norm, you think?
Not. But I think, you know, Santos was able to rack up a pretty, it was a combination of things, right? It was some specific legal financial issues, but it was also the resume issues, and there were a lot of things circulating, and I'm hoping that is such a unique cocktail of wrongdoing that it'll be difficult to replicate and thus difficult to get the bipartisan agreement that you need to expel a member of the House, right? Those of people who are listening to this know that expelling a member is not just a simple majority. You have to have
two-thirds.
You have to have two-thirds, at which probably is going to be in a bipartisan. You're going to need bipartisan support in order to get that done. So I'm hoping we look back at it as, wow, can you believe that this guy got elected and that he even lasted as long as what he did?
And, you know, I tend to think that we'll remember Santos, maybe not even so much for, you know, what the malfeasance was, but just the fact that he became one of the few members of Congress to get to be the butt of, you know, Saturday Night Live jokes, because it's, I mean, you have to break through a certain amount of pop culture to be a joke in Saturday Night Live, because they want people to laugh. They want people to understand who this is, which is why, you know, the people most frequently lampooned on SNL are presidents, because everybody knows who the president is. Very few people know or care who the Senate Majority Leader or the, you know, the, the most junior Supreme Court justice or something like that, you know. But like the fact that Santos got a few, you know, like sort of episodes with cold opens and so forth, is, I think, speaks to his resonance.
And Santos will be remembered as the first founding father to be expelled from Congress. I don't know if you're aware that he was one of the founding fathers or not. He told me he was. So,
I mean,
I'm sure it's true.
Yeah, just take it at face value. So, I mean, again, not to leave the malfeasance, but I feel like I had to get this joke in, you know, just, or this quip in, just because our colleague Herb Jackson, the politics editor at Roll Call, said it when I was musing about different other stories. You know, I said, well, what about Senator, you know, Bob Menendez being indicted again? You know, he was indicted before, you know, a few years back. He beat the rap and, you know, got reelected. And now he's, you know, in the feds, you know, indictment crosshairs again. And Herb kind of laughed and said, let's see. Man from New Jersey accused of corruption. I don't know if that's going to be something that's particularly newsy. Of course, he's joking. He's from New Jersey. If you all have not, if you're listening to the podcast for the first time, but I
maybe we'll look back and say, can you remember back then they didn't use gold bars as their currency? Like maybe in 2073 we'll be right back to a gold bar based economy, and this will be seem funny that, yeah, that was even a thing.
Yeah, why wouldn't you still you know, put gold ingots in your closet? So yeah, I tend to agree. That's, you know, a footnote of best. You know, I mean, again, I'm not trying to downplay the severity of the charges. You know, people are innocent until proven guilty, but I can't imagine that this is going to have particular resonance for people in 2073.
I would hope we're thinking about other things, but
again, back up 50 years ago to us in 1973, the Yom Kippur War led to sort of a scrambling in the Middle East, a redoing of the power structure in the Middle East. It was the first time, you know, that, you know, in terms of the Israel was losing, you know, in true danger in a conflict like this. They were still a little high off of the Six-Day War and, you know, they had captured territory from some of the surrounding Arab states. You know, that sort of veneer of invincibility had been sort of punctured. The Yom Kippur War set off the oil embargo of 1973 that hiked energy prices, that led to, you know, was a big contributing factor to global economy, stagflation, inflation, all kinds of, you know, unhappiness with politicians. I think that is a big thing from 50 years ago. I can't help but think also, though, that the war this year, the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th and the ensuing war in Gaza, has the potential to have a long-reaching effect too, particularly not just for whatever happens for the future of Israel and Gaza and the Palestinians, but we're seeing cracks in the Democratic Party and how they – people in the Democratic Party and their coalition are reacting to this. Let's talk a little bit about that.
I'm hoping, I tried, despite some of my very jaded and pessimistic comments on this podcast over many episodes, I try to be an optimistic person. And I'm hoping that by the time we get to 2073, we will look back at 2023 as an extremely significant point for the Middle East, but also a low point. Like, wow, that was awful and terrible, and everyone, things were, it was very volatile, but that in the ensuing 50 years, we started to figure, we were able to figure it out, right? And I'm not here to prescribe what that looks like, but that that we were somehow able to come to a resolution geographically, politically, that hasn't been able to have been solved for the hundreds and even couple thousand years that we're able to figure that out and look back at this significant but very difficult time.
And the not to just put it back in politics, you know, sort of small p politics here and in DC, but you know, we've seen that right now as Congress is looking to get out of town, they are hung up on what form to send aid to Israel and to humanitarian assistance for Gaza. whether it's coupled with a supplemental for Ukraine in its war against Russia, whether that's also thrown in things on border issues, you know, and maybe Taiwan. But the reaction on Israel, on the Hamas-Israel war, it seems like the Democratic Party, which used to be, you know, sort of this fairly rock solid support of Israel, that there seems to be some cracks in that. And I don't know if it's generational so much, because on one hand, you've got Bernie Sanders saying we should absolutely have conditions on our aid. But it seems like a lot of particularly the youth vote in the Democratic Party is looking at this and saying, why are we giving this unconditional support, which Joe Biden seems to want, to Israel when a lot more Palestinians are getting killed? I mean, it seems like there's a real potential for a fissure in the Democratic Party.
And that fissure could become more, could be even greater here in the next few years, because I think what's holding the Democratic Party together is still probably Trump, or the threat of Trump and the threat of a second term for Trump. At some point, Trump will no longer be a part of the equation. That could be a year from now, or 5 years from now, or whatever it might be. But this conflict, Israel, Palestine, Hamas, I mean, that's probably going to endure. We got 50 years. Let's put 50 years to figure it out. But that's probably going to endure. And you could see that the Democrats have to go through what is the direction. What is the direction for the party if the parties get back to a point where issues matter, right? We have parties focused more on personalities right now, particularly Republicans. But if they become more about issues, then this is something that Democrats are going to have to figure. It's going to be hard to be on one side of that issue, or hard to be on both sides of that issue.
What else? What are we missing? Because, you know, I look at just the first three topics with McCarthy and the speaker drama and Trump and his indictments and Santos and then, you know, throw in the war, you know, just for the last couple of months in Israel. That's a lot of oxygen for the news cycle. But what else has the potential, you think?
I think we could look back at the 2023 into 2024 as, can you believe that the American people had voted between a 78-year-old man and an 81-year-old man for president because of the constitutional amendment to put an age limit on serving as president? I think we could, you know, look back at this election as, wow, can you believe that happened? Because it was just, it'll be almost unthinkable by the time we get to 50 years. And some of you might say, well, you can't have an age limit. It's like, well, we have an age minimum, right? Right. We've set out constitutionally 25 for the House, 30 for the Senate, 35 for president. So if we're setting age minimums, why is it out of unthinkable that we would have a maximum? So I don't know. I'm going to throw that in the mix. Tell me where I'm wrong, Jason.
I don't think you're wrong. And I, you know, not to be morbid, but like thinking about the deaths, you know, that we've seen this year, most of them are like, you know, people in their 90s, right? You know, like these, you know, O'Connor was 93, Kissinger was 100. Norman Lear, not a politician, but somebody who's involved in politics and advocacy, died just before we went on this podcast, 101 years old. You know, Rosalind Carter was 96. I mean, Dianne Feinstein died, you know, like, you know, when you're 90 plus, I mean, that's just simply the, you know, the actuarial tables, right? I mean, like that's not a surprise when people die. And I'm not trying to minimize the tragedy of it or the sadness of it, but people in their 90s who die, you know, that seems like kind of natural. That being said, when you're in your 80s and you're running for president, or if you're in your late 70s and would be in your 80s when you complete your term, as Trump would be if he wins, I just can't help but think, like, is with the country itself is kind of getting younger, right? I mean, like, we're, you know, or at least people that we have plenty of people available to serve in any in capacities, and we do have age limits on other very sensitive, you know, positions. You know, like whether it's, you know, police officers or firefighters. You know, they don't let 80-year-olds run around, you know, like fighting fires, for instance. So, I, you know, when you think about how significant the job is with its adjacency to nuclear weapons and so forth, having somebody, you know, like I just can't help but think that in as we continue to understand aging and the effects on that particularly a stressful job have on somebody, that will certainly be in 50 years, people will be like, wow, that it was weird because they had this thing where they elected a few young people from an earlier
generation. They went the opposite direction.
Yeah, they went from George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and then Trump, and he wasn't that old, but then they kept getting were stuck in this loop, it seemed. And I don't know, it's kind of like with term limits, you would hope that people would what did opponents of term limits say, that the ultimate term limit is the voter itself, but like the voters don't, it seems like we are in this like march where it doesn't seem like we have any other options, but these two men who are just listening, if you listen to either one of them at length, it can get quite painful.
Yeah, I think there's going to be, and maybe the voters will correct that just themselves without any sort of constitutional mandate or maximum, just saying, all right, we went down that route. We tried that route with a couple of different folks and that didn't work out. So we're going to be more mindful of age when we're making these decisions for our officials.
Well, and last week when California Governor Gavin Newsom and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is running for president, of course, but is trailing badly in the polls to Trump, among others. But you saw that debate, as painful as it was to watch and as unentertaining or as uninteresting as it was to watch for so much of it, that seemed like it sort of almost should be. Two people sort of at the height of their powers, two-term governors who are like ready to take the next step to run for president. not somebody who spent a half a century, there's that number again, in the Senate, or somebody who had an entire career in entertainment and real estate, and is, has been eligible for Medicare for years now, to be running for president. I just think like we can do better than that.
Yeah. We'll see. We can. I don't know if we will, but we can. There's potential.
What else?
Now we just have to count how many World Series wins over the next 50 years we'll be reflecting on for the Nationals. But I think that it'll be fun. We should, if podcasts exist back then, we'll see how accurate we are with 2023, considering how important 1973 was. It was amazing to go through that list. But this could be a bigger year than we realize, because we're in the middle of it right now.
I gotta say too that we could have even done 60 years, because 60 years ago we've got another just incredibly like significant year. You have the assassination of John F. Kennedy, you have Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, you have the Birmingham protests and riots. I mean, it was huge. It was this huge Kennedy's, Berlin Wall speech, just a huge, hugely significant. There's something about years, I guess, that ended three. but yeah, it seems like, it's worth keeping an eye on for this stuff. And I appreciate you, talking through.
If we're accurate, hopefully everyone remembers this. And if we're not, then we'll just burn the tapes, even though there aren't tapes anymore.
I think whatever server this will be on in 50 years.
Cloud.
It'll have been shot into space at that point.
With the rest of our trash.
Right. Nathan, thank you so much. I know you've had a very busy day, and I appreciate you taking the time to go through a little time in time travel historian session with me.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
All right. And thanks out there for listening to Political Theater. Please subscribe if you like us. Say nice things about us on the internet for as long as that internet exists. Maybe in 50 years there won't even be one. We'll just have it beam straight into our heads. Thanks, everybody.